Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we are talking with Reason senior editor and historian of the Liberty Movement, Brian Dougherty. Brian, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
All right. You wrote a very interesting piece recently about whether or not libertarians could embrace Trump. What libertarian means as far as you're concerned, what is its kind of core message, as well as, why Trump is the quintessential anti-libertarian, and also why Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian-born economist, author of Human Action and Socialism, Omnipotent Government, and a children's book of nursery rhymes or something, is really the man of the hour that libertarians and other people who believe in classical liberal values should look to. So we're going to talk about those. Let's start with about your piece, which ran recently at Reason. Talk about what it means to be a libertarian to you. What do you see as the quintessence of libertarianism?
Of course, it's all about freedom, baby. And given that we are, spirits in the material world, that freedom has to manifest itself for us to survive in the freedom to own property and to use it and exchange it, right? And the very first thing that Donald Trump did in his first week is sort of strike at the core of that with things like, any company that wants to outsource its building to someplace else, I'm going to make them stop, or I'm going to punish them for doing so. I'm going to build a wall to make sure that humans who might want to come and work here and, trade and exchange with Americans freely aren't going to be able to do that. I'm going to stop the free movement of people for arbitrary reasons not clearly connected, to any actual defense of American lives. This guy clearly has zero respect for that core freedom. And I think in the current context, people who want to either like Trump or maybe just to not, join the chorus of rabble who are like overly afraid of Trump will point to things like, oh, but his appointments, like he might appoint an FDA head who has some intelligent thoughts about regulating
medicines. And by an intelligent thought, you mean by essentially abolishing the FDA?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Or at the very least, allowing a sort of freer, easier access to medicines that have at the very least been proven safe, even if not proven efficacious, which is a point that a lot of people miss. So at any rate, I did want to grant that, yeah, there's a couple of things that Trump's, not even really Trump, but that Trump's appointees have said and that we might guess they've done that might increase freedom. But in judging what this guy is all about and what his administration is all about, I think those things that he front and centered in that first week show that basic core freedom, the freedom to do what you want to do with your property, which means being able to buy and sell with people no matter what side of a national border they're on, to do business with such people, to invite such people into your home, to hire such people. He's violently opposed to those core freedoms. And I think it's wrong to just sort of create a checklist of like, oh, pros and cons from a libertarian perspective.
So that means that, you can't simply say, okay, on the one hand, there's the border wall. On the other
right,
hand, there's
exactly.
Betsy DeVos
like,
expanding school
right.
choice.
It's like he's for school choice, but he thinks he has the right to tell you that you can't, take your capital and move it to Mexico or wherever.
Or that you can't actually, you can't have a Mexican actually teach Spanish in your charter school.
Exactly. So that's it. I mean, I feel like if you don't get that and
Let me ask a couple of things based on what you've said so far. And, the first is you talk about in the piece, libertarianism is a unified skein. Is it skein or skein? Do we know?
I just write them. I don't say them.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah. Pronunciation is for suckers. But libertarianism, you write, is a unified skein of beliefs about how the human social order should be shaped. What binds the philosophy is the understanding that using violent force against the peaceful both makes us overall poorer and is, at any rate, almost always or always wrong. Is there room, before we go on to Trump a bit more and then Ludwig von at the as well, Is there room for a kind of cafeteria libertarianism, or perhaps maybe not that, because you can't be like, well, you know, I'm for the free trade of goods, but I will kill any foreigner that, you know, comes across the border. That seems kind of strange. But to define libertarian in less of a kind of totalitarian or totalist philosophical terms, can you be a little bit libertarian? Can you be temperamentally libertarian?
There's at least two different levels to that. There may be more. I might get to a third as I talk through this. On one level is the strategic, you know, in terms of, okay, if there's this libertarian movement of institutions and politicians and activists who want to see America move in a more libertarian direction, in that case, there's certainly room for making common cause with people who don't actually get the whole package, and maybe they're just good on one issue or another, and there's certainly little, you know, political gain to be made by being, you know, a total, you know, libertarian, you know, building a border wall around the concept of libertarianism and saying, you know, you can't get through this until I approve of you entirely. That's certainly
I'm
true.
Sorry, you got, you know, the national animal is a frog. You got that wrong. You're not a libertarian.
Right,
what nine out of 10 is, you know, kind of makes sense if you're talking about building political coalitions.
Right. So I was writing, and there's a level at which someone might think what I was even trying to do in this article we're talking about, like, isn't even worth doing. But I do believe it's worth doing, which is sort of trying to explain to those who do think of themselves as part of the libertarian coalition, like sort of trying to guide them to what do we make of this strange man, Trump, who, you know, on one day does something, and it's generally appointments. I have to say, I don't think I've really heard a good thing out of Trump's mouth at all. But like some of the people he's appointed have said, or we can presume might do things that a libertarian should cheer. And yet there's also this other stuff. And this is, again, takes it down to strategy. I do think, and I fully grant that I may be suffering from what the folks call Trump derangement syndrome. There's people who feel that a lot of us are just way more panicked about him than we should be, and I grant the possibility that time may prove that true. But I do think all that first week stuff with the wall and the tariffs and the you can't build your, you know, plant overseas and I'm going to charge you 35% extra if you do, like, that stuff is super alarming, and it shows that what he's all about at his core is a set of ideas that he's probably getting from the notorious Steve Bannon, who smartly hasn't said a whole lot public, you know, since becoming, you know, the most powerful man in the world or whatever Bannon is now. But from what we do know about Bannon, he is very dedicated to what I call in the piece a sort of ethno-nationalism. It's not merely a nationalism that says, okay, we're, you know, America is about America and we're going to do what's best for America, because I think that you can make totally libertarian arguments within that form of nationalism, because I do believe that libertarianism is good for America, you know, I think it's an internationalist nationalism, you know. I think it's best for America if we do trade, you know, with others, if we do let more people in than we do. I think that makes America stronger and better. So you can be, I'm for America first,
right,
and I'm mostly libertarian. I think
this
that can
is
work.
The idea that is saying, you know, being a citizen of America and a citizen of the world, you know, that these are mutually exclusive or even opposed to one another is a really banal and I guess a Bannonite way of seeing things, because I love my country and I also love, you know, having fruits, you know, tropical fruits in the wintertime. And I like the idea of I like neighbors who come from different places. What's
right.
wrong with that?
And Bannon seems to believe, and you can sort of trace this through some links in my piece, both that A, it's somehow necessary for America that we make all of the things that we, you know, use and consume within these national borders, which is ridiculous and impoverishes us, and also that the ethnic background of the people who constitute the American populace is actually very important and must be preserved in a certain direction that is more white and more European. And it's not even that he's you know, you sort of hear the casual insult of, oh, you're scared of brown people or whatever. He's, you know, it's not even just, oh, poor Mexicans or poor Hispanics that he seems annoyed by. He actually seems annoyed by the notion of, you know, Asians, you know, coming here, you know, computer workers. He actually said to Trump in front of a reporter that, yeah, it's, you know, it's not okay necessarily that all of these Asians come in because, you know, we're there's more to us than just an economy. We're a civic society, as if the nature of civic society is somehow dependent on the ethnic background of the people making it up. And that's a distinctly un-American idea and a distinctly un-libertarian idea. And he seems real serious about it. And that's alarming.
Yeah, I think we could talk him into really, you know, I think even tan people he's generally against. You know, we could, if, it, you know, in his unexpurgated comments, I got a feeling that Southern Italians probably don't make the test. Certainly Arabs don't. Let me ask you, you know, though, on another level also, what about, you know, and obviously a huge part he has actually talked about and you know, produce documentaries about this, about how really what America is at war with is Islam, which strikes me as insane and stupid and pathetic. And it's horrible that we are really going to have to engage that type of mentality for the next 4 years at the very least, and actually have been engaging it for, you know, the past 8 or 15 years in any case, or 16 years. But is there a case to be made from a libertarian point of view that allowing people who come to this country who are intolerant, who do not believe in pluralism, is there, you know, is there a case to be said, okay, you know what, you know, in order to migrate freely, you know, you can't have communicable diseases, you can't be, you know, a known criminal fleeing the law or something like that, and I guess we could negotiate on that. But also that you have to sign on to a certain set of beliefs that constitute an American creed of live and let live.
I'll give a Mises answer to that first. Mises never, you know, brought this down to the level of a specific policy proposal, but certain things he's written might indicate that he might agree with the idea you led forth. I mean, he actually wrote in his book Liberalism that we must be tolerant of everything but intolerant. So it's possible that even through a Misesian lens, you could say, yeah, it's bad for a liberal polity to have too many people who don't believe in the principles of liberalism. I'm not comfortable declaring that as a, you know, legal barrier to immigration because I think it proves a little too much. I think if we start granting that, yeah, we have to, you know, enforce pro-liberal in the classical sense thought control on the populace, whether it be the people we're letting in or the people who are already here. That seems like it's a recipe, you know, for you know, the suede denim police or whatever the Kennedy song. You know, it's like, yeah. I'm not comfortable.
Right.
I get that point, and certainly at a certain point, a liberal society will collapse if no one believes in liberalism any longer. But I'm not comfortable with imposing that by law, whether on natives or on immigrants.
Well, that would be great, actually. I mean, I'm all for, you know, anything, because I, like you, I'm a globalist and a liberal internationalist in a classical sense, a rootless cosmopolite. As long as we're applying the same entry, you know, test to native-born people as we are to immigrants, I think everything will be fine. You know, I mean, it'll be a much emptier country. But I also love the idea that, you know, when people talk about that kind of stuff, which I kind of get, and, you know, I raise it because I think you're absolutely right that if in a liberal society, in a, you know, a kind of open and tolerant and pluralistic society, if people stop believing in that, you get into trouble pretty quickly. But one of the great unacknowledged facts of life is that children always disappoint their parents in fun and interesting ways. And there was a movement shortly after the Pilgrims and the Puritans first showed up in Massachusetts in the 17th century called the Halfway Covenant, because it turned out within a generation or two, the kids who were born on American soil were like, you know, mom and dad, we're going to church too much. I'm not going to be as religious as you. Almost immediately, and then the powers that be came up with something they called the Halfway Covenant, where they were like, okay, look, kids, you just have to be half as religious as us. So it's almost in the American DNA is this sense of, you know, that your kids you know, to quote Bob Dylan or to paraphrase Bob Dylan, you know, that your kids are beyond your control. It's like, you know, you never know what's going to happen. So,
well, and certainly it's not the fault of immigrants that America over the past 60 or 70 years has become more, you know, progressive and statist. You know, it's they didn't do it. You know, that was.
Are you going to say it's women giving women the vote is what did that?
Other people have said that. No, it is Americans themselves who have failed America.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. You know, Pat Buchanan, who is in many ways the kind of unacknowledged philosopher king of Trumpism.
Yeah.
I reviewed one of his books, you know, back about 10 years ago when I completely ignorantly treated Buchananism as sort of this like dying rump of an old fashioned, you know, I had no idea it would end up ruling the world, you know, by 2016. But at any rate, I pointed out that he sort of had these dual complaints going alongside, and Bannon is like this, and Trump as well, of like both, A, everything about American culture and government is getting worse and worse and worse, and we're becoming less and less white European. But there was clearly no connection between the two complaints. Like, everything that was going wrong with the country in their mind, if you divorce it from the horrible problem of looking at people, you know, of Latin American descent when you look around you, you know, none of it had anything to do with racial or ethnic background. It was mistakes and ideological changes and foolishness of that, you know, alleged brave white, you know, European American stock that we needed.
Well,
I blame
the Roosevelts and all of those fancy people who lived in upstate New York, you know, in the 20s and 30s and 40s, right?
Sure.
It wasn't the Gillespies and Guidas and the Dohertys who destroyed America, right?
Indeed. And yeah, and as you point out, if people like Bannon, you know, were in 1890, of course, the people they'd be against would be the Irish Doherty and, you know, the Italians. Gillespie and
well, actually,
you know,
Gillespie
to say that they wouldn't have been right that we destroyed America, but
I know at least four I met. Well, actually, I only met three of my grandparents. One died before I was born, but they were all immigrants, and I think you could make a very strong case to have kept them out, at least as individuals, if not as racial paradigms. So where do you think, you know, talk a little bit about Bannon and Trump, and I'm slower than you. Obviously Bannon has been, you know, cast in the role of evil genius. He is Karl Rove. He is Valerie Jarrett, I think, played this role for Obama, you know, where the president is always a puppet. There's always a Richelieu, you know, in the background pulling the strings. But, you know, and so I'm willing to say, you know, it's Trump is an idiot, but, you know, these are his ideas as well. But we can just call it Trumpism. Where is that coming from at this late date in human history? I mean, you know, the idea of ethnic solidarity of whites, which is an even more fantastical and, you know, bullshit category than brown people or yellow people or red people, it seems to me. You know, where is that coming from? Is it a mirror image of the identity politics that the left has been insisting on, or generally the left has been insisting on for the past 30 or 40 years?
There's a little bit of that, and I read probably a lot more stuff from that kind of alt-right world than is good for me, and have been since, you know, the early 90s, and again when I treated it as sort of like, huh, this curious little weird excrescence on the edge of the right that's going, you know, out. You know, I wrote about Samuel Francis in Reason in 1994 as what seemed like a weird curiosity. And again, he's sort of like the puppet philosopher behind, you know, everything that happened.
And even he admitted like his ideas were dying.
Exactly. Yeah. He'd have been surprised if he had lived to see this.
It would have killed him. Right?
Yeah,
2016,
exactly.
He would have died of, you know, of excitement.
And there's so much you see in there that really is the mirror image of the kind of complaints that blacks and women and gays had from, you know, the 1920s to the 1980s that led to the changes. This feeling that, like, the culture around me isn't respecting me and it's abusive of my values and it doesn't value me. And, like, yeah, it no one wants to feel that way, and if people feel that way in a culture, they're gonna, you know, do something to try to change it. And, you know, blacks, gays, women's, Hispanics, whatever minority you want to speak of, have had some but not enough success in turning that around. And now all the white European, you know, college boys are like, oh, I'm being told that being a white man is bad. And take Trump, you know, now Trump's
well,
president.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, from a kind of PC perspective, the one thing that you can say is that up until, you know, the mid 60s, at the very least, if you were black, there were certain places you absolutely couldn't go. There were certain places you absolutely couldn't vote. If you were a woman, you face certain types of, you know, not just de facto, but de jure segregation. And this, you know, gays had, you know, no ability to kind of act freely in the open. Whereas I think, you know, people living in Wisconsin, white people living in Wisconsin who, you know, have a university degree, you know, who are men, it's a tougher case for them to say, you know, they're in a kind of parallel situation now where they're being disrespected or their way of life is not being valued.
Yeah, but they definitely feel it. That feeling is real, and they're not self-aware enough to realize that it's an exact mirror image of you know, the complaints that all of the people who they now want to be free to make fun of or publicly say that they don't like or don't respect or whatever. Mises, mm-hmm. you know, to mention him again, kind of had the answer to all of this, that in a world where we didn't have to care whether, you know, say Hillary Clinton called us a deplorable because we had a certain attitude, or Donald Trump seems concerned about, you know, what bathroom we use, like, you wouldn't have to worry about that in a realm of true classical liberal government. That would all be just something you could, you know, fight out or not fight out amongst yourselves, and the best solution to make the world as rich and wonderful and varied as it can be is just to, you know, live and let live.
I'm going to quote a bit from Mises that this is in your piece at Reason, and I'll give the title of that at the end of the podcast. But in his 1944 book, Omnipotent Government, Mises imagines a truly liberal, a classically liberal, what we would now call a libertarian world. And he says, there are no trade barriers. Men can live and work where they want. Frontiers are drawn on the maps, but they do not hinder the migrations of men and shipping of commodities. Natives do not enjoy rights that are denied to aliens. That is, you know, just unfucking believable, actually. I'm reading that, I get chills because it seems to speak so directly not only to kind of libertarian fever dreams, but also, wow, you know, how out of step with either the Democratic or the Republican Party, to be quite honest, or most liberals and conservatives. That is such a radical statement. For listeners who may not be as familiar with Ludwig von Mises as you are, give a quick, capsule biography of Ludwig von.
Sure. What makes that attitude on his part more interesting and more inspiring is he was not, you know, a groovy, you know, modern guy in a sort of a post-war sense. He was born in 1881. He was an Austrian from, you know, the Von class, you know, is his family name.
Barons,
had Von in it. You know, he was a university professor. He was a very, you know, he was not a funky or groovy guy. You know, he was a very stern, whatever image you'd have of an old world Austrian professor. That was who he was. But he wanted a world where people were free, and he wanted a world where people were rich. And he saw, you know, he was an Austrian born in 1881, which means he was living there when the whole Nazi thing happened. He was driven out of his beloved native land. He saw this civilization that he valued so much get destroyed by, you know, not just Marxian communism, which of course he was also against, but by the sort of ethno-national fascism that believed in the same kind of national self-sufficiency that Bannon and Trump believe in. He saw it destroy the way of life he loved. And, you know, if you read him, you can certainly read him say things that would be considered un-PC in modern terms. Like, he will use terms like savages to describe, you know, certain civilizations. But at the very same time, he's also excoriating the European powers for their, you know, forceful theft and subjugation of these so-called savages, because he represented, or he understood and believed in universal human values, and he believed that the free trade of goods and people across the globe made everyone richer. He understood this to be true as an economist. He believed it to be right as a social philosopher, And that leaves no room whatsoever for the core of Trump, you know, to get back to what libertarians should think about Trump. And one thing I want to say is that it's funny. It's actually, as a libertarian, it warms my heart to see in arguments I've gotten with people online since this piece appeared, how much people want, in some cases, to be able to think of themselves as libertarians. Like, I've had quite a few people get mad at me for, like, no, I'm all for Trump on this border wall thing, but how dare you say I'm not a libertarian? I'm like, well, it's okay. You know, it's not key to anyone's self-image, or it shouldn't be, to think of yourself as a libertarian. But if libertarian means, as it has meant for most of the 20th century, this sort of Misesian classical liberal tradition expanded and toughened, you know, in the 20th century, you're not. I mean, it's great if you believe in low taxes or whatever good thing that you do believe in, but and you don't actually understand free market economics either, I think, if you're a protectionist autarkist, you know, which means national self-sufficiency, in the way Trump and Bannon are. I mean, and if you do believe, if you support free market policies in some areas, great, but I'm not sure what your intellectual basis for doing so is if you don't understand the free trade and free migration arguments.
So did Mises, did he come to his cosmopolitanism, which may not quite be the accurate word for it, but his kind of international
he used the term cosmopolite for himself in his book Liberalism, so yeah, we can say that.
Yeah, okay, but you know, did he come to that you know, from his study of economics, you know, for him? And I realize, like, he kind of throws it all against the wall at various points, but there's kind of a moral argument there. There's a pragmatic argument there. There is a you know, kind of conditional or a consequentialist argument that we will all be freer, we will all be richer if we do this, that, and the other thing. And what did the role of growing up in, you know, I guess the Austrian-Hungarian Empire? He was Jewish. You know, what did the, but he was also of a landed class, because of the, as the Vaughan indicates, you know, how did these things, how did they produce him?
Yeah, his belief in the value of this stuff was, he didn't use the word much, but we would call it pragmatic. He was not, you know, a believer in the metaphysical rights of man. He as an economist, and he would always insist his economics had no political values embedded in them, but it's definitely true that his political values had economics embedded in them, in the sense that his understanding of economics led him to believe that, okay, we're all going to be richer the, you know, wider and more complicated these chains of production and chains of exchange get, and there is no reason to restrict them to existing national boundaries. So in his free market economics led him to his political liberalism, because he was a decent man who wanted us all to be richer and freer. You know, yeah. It's like that.
I guess it's also true that the boundaries in Europe, and particularly in the 19th century, were, you know, and certainly through a good chunk of the 20th century, were constantly being redrawn. Yeah. That only an insane person could really believe in the primacy of national borders, because everything was changing. And I always think of him in relation also to Joseph Schumpeter, who was also born in part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And, you know, everywhere he lived essentially ceased to exist a few years after he showed up. And yeah. I suspect that's true of Mises as well.
Yeah, and as you'd said, he had the experience of being Jewish in a polity that was by no means majority Jewish, but realizing that, hey, yeah, it's better for everyone if we build a culture in which the contributions of people of all religions, all races, and all nationalities are permitted and honored. Like, he saw this, and then he saw the obverse of these ideas, the Nazi idea of racial purity, national self-sufficiency. He saw it destroy a beautiful civilization that he grew up in. He saw it, you know, end millions of people's lives. He personally and his family were driven from Europe entirely, and he ended up in America in the early 40s and teaching here at NYU until his death. So yeah, he saw all this happen, and unfortunately, you know, not a lot of people making policy in America right now actually lived through it. And you know, these crummy ideas whose evil flowering Mises lived through were just sort of, oh yeah, that happened in the past, but we're different, we're America, you know.
And again, to talk about when you were underscoring that he was not a hippie, he was not, you know, I mean, he is as kind of Austrian as you can get. I mean, he writes with a German accent, even in English. Every picture of him, he's stern looking. He makes Captain Von Trapp and the Sound of Music look like wavy gravy or something.
Yeah.
I mean, he is so uptight. And it's kind of amazing that he has this legacy of a, you know, I think of a bracingly beautiful and inspirational world that is populated by particular people and particular customs that exist in particular places and times, but also one that is totally open and pluralistic and peaceful and about engagement. Where do we place Mises in contemporary libertarian movement debates? Because one of the things that I find interesting is that groups like the Von Mises Institute in Alabama often talks about autarky as a kind of good thing, or they like the small town. They like, you know, this is an institution that is named for Mises, but they seem to be opposed to his kind of internationalism in most ways. And then there are a lot of other economists in the libertarian movement who seem to embrace Hayek, his student. Where in many ways Hayek was much more about kind of compromising with forces of, you know, that might lead in a direction that's more like Trump. He didn't seem to be as categorical in his dismissals of impositions on a kind of truly liberal free order. What can we say about Mises' current position within the libertarian movement?
It is a unfortunate irony, as you noted, that the organization that's named itself after Mises is sort of the most un-Misesian when it comes to these questions of free movement of goods and people. The people working under that banner have been among people in sort of the libertarianish thought world the most enthusiastic about Trump. You know, most of the time they'll claim that the reason for that is mostly foreign policy stuff, right? And indeed, Mises was also an extreme defender of liberalism as the best guarantee of peace, another key element of a healthy and valuable culture. Like, you don't want war on any level. So they'll say that. I think there is some argument to be made that maybe Trump will be less likely to engage the U.S. in wars overseas, though honestly I never thought the argument was very good, and I think it gets worse every day, but we don't know yet. And also, a lot of people on that side have invented for themselves arguments that they think sound libertarian against open immigration, and to me they're incredibly unconvincing. They're along the lines of either, well, you know, public property in the U.S., we love private property, right? So shouldn't the U.S. government treat public property like private property and just say no one can come into it, right? That's libertarian, right? And in fact it's not. And in fact, by any sort of even quasi-Lockean derivation of private property in a world without a state, there'd be tons and tons, like vast majorities of the globe would be unowned. It's not like suddenly we'd become a world of 100% private property, because humans have not done the things by which property in the land, you know, should have been earned. The trick that governments pull is they just say, hey, everything that we've encircled, it's ours. And that's not, you know, how private property works. So I think that's a BS argument. And then there's the argument that we alluded to earlier, that sort of like, well, if we really believe in preserving a free culture, we can't let in these people who are going to vote welfare for themselves and vote for a bigger state. And again, that sort of argument proves way too much. If you actually believe that it's libertarian appropriate to, you know, oppress people because not oppressing them might make the welfare state more expensive, you know, that's an argument for Chinese-level population control. That's an argument for, you know, educational propaganda and thought control. It proves too much. And the fact that certain people find those arguments convincing only when it comes to immigration does lead you to believe that maybe there's a little bit of an element of ethnocentrism slash racism involved in it. And it's hard to avoid that. And yeah, it's unfortunate because Mises should be, as I tried to point out in this piece, and as Mises' disciple Murray Rothbard points out in this great essay called Mises as the Laissez-faire Radical, which was written before Rothbard himself took a culturally conservative turn, make the case that, yeah, Mises really is the grooviest, you know, believer in peace and freedom and free movement and the mixing of the races and, you know, whatever, you know, whatever liberal egghead thing you might name, that's all the heart of Mises. And I do think that the associations of some of his acolytes, whether it be Rothbard or the people running the Mises Institute, have made certain respectable academic intellectuals and, you know, policy types in the libertarian thought world sort of find the name Mises a little bit, you know, dirty. And it's a shame that they think that, because the actual Mises was like as great as could be in terms of cosmopolitanism and freedom and peace and all the good things.
Will you be writing a book, Mises as I Know Him?
I do think there probably is room, you know, for those interested in the intellectual history of this stuff
yeah.
to sort of rehabilitate Mises. And
well, I would like to think that he doesn't need that much. He doesn't need an extreme makeover, but he certainly, I think, is the man of the hour. And I have to say the first book of his I read was Socialism, which is just fantastic. And you can read it straight through, or you can dip into it. You can read it as if it's written by a character, you know, a crazy German guy in a Thomas Pynchon novel, or as just like a brilliant expositor of classical liberalism. And, you know, Human Action is fantastic. Bureaucracy is – I mean, the guy has a shelf full of books, and they're all worth reading. What would you suggest that somebody interested in Mises start with?
Right now, in the midst of the current crises, the two best ones are two of his shorter ones, which is fortunate. There's his book Liberalism in the Classical Tradition, which is where he lays out the whole groovy peace, free trade, free migration – case for a world that's richer and better for everyone. It's not too bogged down in the technical economics. The other is the book he wrote about how Germany and Nazism, you know, kind of ruined the 20th century, written during World War II, came out in 1944, called Omnipotent Government. And that's the one that makes it the most clear to me, and I think to any American reading it now, that, hey, Bannonism, Trumpism is indeed taking us down an extremely alarming path. I mean, it's of course extremely damaging to anyone's reputation to ever suggest that, oh, anything about the worst parts of World War II might actually be repeated. Like, it just makes it sound like a lunatic to say that. But, you know, the things that Trump and Bannon seem to consider most important to do in the first 2 weeks, you know, when you read Omnipotent Government and read the history of Nazism and what drove them, it's certainly alarming.
And, you know, it's in terms of the immigration stuff, I find it particularly disturbing that it's not like Trump is necessarily out there leading the parade. You know, shortly after he put out his first executive order banning all refugees and immigrants from seven Muslim majority countries for a few months, which later was stayed and I guess has now been repudiated or taken off the table. But two Republican senators, Tom Cotton of Arkansas and I think it's Sonny Perdue of Georgia, actually introduced legislation to cut legal immigration in half. So it, you know, in the National Review magazine, which has its own kind of tormented history with white ethnocentrism, they attacked Donald Trump for being soft on immigration in their big issue in December of 2015, where they said they were never Trump. They said that his plan to deport 11 million people was actually just an amnesty program in disguise. So, where do you go, or do you have a sense of how do you convince people who take that kind of ethnic solidarity so seriously that they're willing to say, I want to separate families in America. I want to kick out people who entered here illegally 15 or 20 years ago but have worked and paid taxes and have never gotten into trouble. They got to get out of the country. Where do you go to even start a conversation where you might convince them that they've got it all wrong.
Well, there are times when I believe that, you know, no one over the age of 17 can be convinced of everything. What I tried to do, especially arguing for people who think of themselves as on the right, you know, Republican Party, conservative or whatever, what I tried to do in that article that we started off talking about is sort of say to them, it's like, look, one of the things you think you believe in is mostly is freedom and free markets, right? That's a core part of what you think, and sort of try to lay out for them why their weird obsession with immigration and trade is in fact completely antithetical to what they claim to believe in most other cases about freedom and free markets. And hopefully, if they're coming at it from any sort of an intellectual level, that can be convincing. My fear about a lot of these things that are rooted in ethnicity and rooted in the sense that, oh, it's our family and our tribe and we should be making our own clothes and growing our own food or whatever, like work on kind of a sub rational level, and you know, you're not going to win everyone,
you would expect somebody who understands the lump of labor fallacy would also understand the lump of Latino fallacy as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like you just, not everyone, you know, insists on complete coherence in their, you know, thought, obviously, but for people who do, you want to start someplace where they already are a supposed understanding of the values of free markets and liberty, and then walk them to where you think they should be, which is why, you know,
you're going to walk them behind the 7-Eleven where they can be jumped by members of the MS-13. I see this plan all the way. I see all the way through. Well, what about on the on the left or liberals or progressives? Because, you know, one of the possible good outcomes of a Trump presidency, and it's, you know, and we also have to keep in mind that whatever Trump as president or Bannon as his advisor wants, you know, political dynamics always have a kind of energy of their own, and you never know what's going to happen. So we may end up, you know, freer. We may end up, against the wishes of what they're trying to do. But with one of the early things that I know a lot of libertarians were kind of upbeat about when Trump won is that, okay, well, now liberals are going to understand why you don't want a really powerful executive branch, why you want the rule of law and you want consensus in Congress. You don't want to pass something like Obamacare with no consensus, only with partisan votes and things like that. Do you think any of that is true, or will people broadly, you know, liberals, leftists, progressives, will they understand that, kind of if you reap a powerful collectivism based on ethnic identity, that, you know, that can be used against you. It can be used in a way that becomes really ugly and creates an America that's even worse than the one that you're trying to correct right now.
I have become very pessimistic, especially in kind of the social networking age where it's much easier for us to actually get direct reports from the minds of, you know, thousands of people who we might not otherwise have heard from, about how successful arguments based on principle as opposed to arguments based on my team is going to win are going to be. I mean, everything you said is 100% true. It needs to be said, and it will be said. Whether it actually sticks in the minds of, you know, the other side in American political terms, who undoubtedly will control the reins of power again, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8 years from now, I'm not that optimistic, but that doesn't mean that very vital point should not be said over and over and over again. And hopefully we'll keep doing that.
Okay. And a final question for Brian Dougherty about Ludwig von Mises. And if you're interested in libertarian history, of course, read Radicals for Capitalism, his encyclopedic history of the contemporary libertarian movement or the modern post-war libertarian movement. Brian, there is always this calumny that is thrown out at Ludwig von Mises that the one thing he believed the government should subsidize is opera. Is there any, have you been able to find any truth to that?
This is a real gotcha. I used to know the answer to this, and I cannot speak authoritatively to it. And if indeed he said anything that could be implied that way, it means he was wrong, by the architectonic structure that he built throughout his 40 years of writing. Even Mises can misunderstand Mises, lesser men have misunderstood him.
Do you think that he, what do you think, and I'm trying to think, because he died in 72, correct?
73, I believe.
73, okay. So then he would have been around for the entire run of Iggy and the Stooges albums. Would he have liked that? Or would he have been repulsed by that, even as he welcomed, the Ashton brothers as boarders in his house or in his neighborhood?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly the point. I think he would have found it a horrible, repulsive mess, and yet he would have also understood that, some people seem to enjoy it. People are buying it. It's making their life better. It's not hurting my life, except when the neighbor next door is playing it too loud. And, let a thousand stooges bloom.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. We've been talking with Brian Dougherty. His the piece that we're talking about here is up at Reason.com. It's called Trump's Dangerous Anti-Libertarian Nationalism. The subtitle is Promises to Cut Domestic Regulations or Shake Up the System. Do not a tolerable libertarian make. Trump is indeed a major threat to core libertarian values. Ask Ludwig von Mises. You know what I like about that subtitle, Brian, is that it's longer than most of the articles that I write. So, but it is Brian Dougherty. He's a senior editor at Reason. He's the author of, among other books, Radicals for Capitalism, A Freewheeling History of the Libertarian Movement. Brian, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason.